Running a business comes with a lot of what-ifs, but luckily there's a simple answer to them. Shopify. It's the commerce platform behind millions of businesses, including Thrive Cosmetics and Momofuku, and it'll help you with everything you need. From website design and marketing to boosting sales and expanding operations, Shopify can get the job done and make your dream a reality. Turn those what-ifs into... Sign up for your $1 per month trial at shopify.com/special offer.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Kilmeade. Welcome to the latest moments of the show. Mike Rowe is in studio, and he has never been happier. He's been in other studios, but this is the pinnacle of his career, according to reports. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West at the bottom of the hour. And, of course, today's kind of a big day. For me, anyway, because the president will join in with FIFA and announce a task force to sell the World Cup. There's actually World Team Championships, Club Championships this year, and then next year the World Cup. It'll be the number one story at this point. And Fox, of course, carries it. So before we get to Mike Rowe and his brand new project, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
They keep circling back to the same narrative that there was nothing to see there. And then all of a sudden, the American people got to see it on the debate stage. And what we're seeing now is them trying to rewrite history.
But the problem is Mark Meadows, who was chief of staff to Trump, won. We all saw, and two more books have been written. That makes four of all the failings of Joe Biden during his 4 years. Was he ever in charge? Plus, a problem on the Democratic side. No one's retiring. Not even leaving room for the next generation. I hope they can work it out.
Number two.
Oh, we've just made it abundantly clear until they can come on board and fight anti-Semitism, obey the laws that the Supreme Court have put in place. Their answer to us was filing a lawsuit on freedom of speech. That is not the issue. It's a civil rights issue on campus.
And that is Linda McMahon, the Secretary of Education. Harvard slammed face first into the turnbuckle by the former WWE executive. I don't think anyone's coming out of the locker room to save Harvard this time. We look at Trump's war on anti-Semitic elite education.
Number one.
There's an opportunity here that if we can do it, the goal on one side, I call it reprivatizing the government or reprivatizing the U.S. economy. By the time President Trump leaves office, we're back at the long-term average of about 3.5% deficit to GDP.
Yep, showing strength. Scott Bessent shined on the Milken stage as markets rise. What we need to know are trade deals and what's going on with China, who are showing signs of weakness. Mike Rowe, you never do. You got a brand new series called People You Know. It's coming out on YouTube. And these are everyday people doing extraordinary things who aren't getting the attention until you show up.
You're so close, Brian. It's People You Should Know. Now, People You Know is a bit more optimistic and more reflective. But this is sort of geared toward the future. Like, you should know the people I'm going to introduce you
right.
to. Why? Because they're the neighbors that that you wish you had. They're just regular people.
How do you find them?
Well, you know, it's funny. A few years ago, I did a show for Facebook called Returning the Favor. This is similar to that. And what happened with that show is we took the first few episodes and we produced them like producers do. You go out, you look, you find somebody who's, you know, up to their neck in some sort of great endeavor. And then once you put it out there and people see it, for whatever reason, the shows I work on all wind up being programmed by the viewer. Dirty Jobs, Somebody's Got to Do It, and Now People You Should Know. The same thing is going to happen because everybody knows somebody.
So they'll reach out to you.
Absolutely.
And they're your bookers.
Well, yeah. Actually, the people I feature on the show become the host. The people who watch the show become the programmers and the bookers. I'm basically just a side of meat that, you know, goes around in a van and smiles. And then, you know, we surprise these people with an elaborate gift at the end of a long day. They think they're in a documentary. They're actually there to be honored. The town comes out. People cry. This woman in the current episode now on my YouTube channel is called Lindsay Phillips. And she's in an organization called Care Portal. And, Brian, your listeners will love this. Care Portal, anybody can go online into the Care Portal and see at a glance anyone in their community who's maybe they're struggling, could be any number of things. And it's a mechanism whereby anybody can get involved and help.
And I think I saw this. She had all types of tragedy in her. She had an addiction.
She was, by her own admission, a full-on meth head. And she nearly lost her two kids. Somehow she got it turned around with the help of this organization. And now her whole life is focused on paying it forward. So is it a feel-good show? Yeah. Is it earnest? Yeah. But it's also the making of a feel-good show. And if you know me, you know there's going to be a fair amount of calamity and mistakes and hilarity that precedes all of this. So
that's where you have some fun.
That's where I can be me. And we check a lot of boxes with this, and it's been super cool to put it on YouTube.
Well, that's great, too. And then, of course, when everyone talks about what's going on with the government right now and talks about trying to bring manufacturing back, people think dirty jobs, like, oh, like it's going to be the rugged thing working in a coal mine. But do you think manufacturing has changed to be a little bit more domesticated, a little bit more?
It's changed so much and so fast that most people haven't got the memo.
They have a different image of it. They think 1920s, grime on the face. I've been working all day.
Think of like if you close your eyes and somebody says, you know, plumber. What do you see? The odds are good. It's still going to be a 300-pound dude with a giant butt crack, right? Somebody who won a vocational consolation prize. It's just not true. We've got 2,200 people who have come through my foundation. None of them have a four-year degree. They all learned a skill that's in demand, some in manufacturing, many in the skilled trades, and many making six figures or about to do so. The myths and the misperceptions and the stigmas and the stereotypes around this kind of work are legion. And debunking them is something I've been trying to do for a while.
You know, I saw, of all people, Randy Weingarten, the head of the teachers union, come out and say, parents, get used to the fact that some of your kids shouldn't go to college and accept when they say they don't want to go. And I'm thinking to myself, that's the head of education, because vocational school.
Yeah.
And because of the perception through my time, I mean, I felt it. If you weren't going to college and joined the military, I can remember the three guys that joined the military, and I can remember the maybe five guys that went right into a job.
Yeah.
It was kind of, you almost felt bad for the parents.
Well, see,
and that's got to change.
It's got to change, because right away, look, I mean, good for her for saying that, but if you
frame, I'm not a fan.
Look, a busted clock's right twice a day, right?
Okay.
And so it's what the mistake is, to set the table the way it's been set for 40 years. So a career in the trades or a career in manufacturing, if you set it up so that those things are fallback positions to the default, which is a four-year degree, then you've already taken the bait. You're already screwed. That's why Gen Z is taking it in the neck right now. $1.7 trillion in student loans. That happened because we told a whole generation of people that they were screwed if they didn't go in this direction.
But you know what also happened? Today, you have to start paying your loans back. So everyone's listening to this subject with a little bit more of with a keener ear. And I would say this. A lot of people are like, oh, you should have been paying back the whole way. Mostly middle-class people are the ones who took out the parent loans and the regular loans. Working class get a lot of grants. There's a lot of things, aid built in.
Yeah.
And the upper class doesn't matter because they have the money. The $70,000 doesn't really feel it. So the middle class who said, I'll do anything for my kids, University of Michigan, out of state, $70,000, I'll find a way. My kid got in,
right.
I'll do it.
Right.
And now they turn around, they owe $340,000. They got to pay back at 9%.
It's crushing.
And guess what the school does when they raise the cap on loans?
Mm.
They raise the tuition.
Of course.
So someone's got to in and fix that metric. I hope Trump's the one to do it.
I hope he is too, because nothing in the history of Western civilization has become more expensive more quickly than a four-year degree. Not food, not gas, not energy.
Did not know that.
Not real estate. Nothing. Nothing. And so, you know, when people say to me, Mike, how the hell did college get so expensive? I'm like, well, how could it not? I mean, you literally put so much pressure on a whole generation of kids to borrow whatever it took to go. And that pressure, to your point, is not just on the kids. It's on their parents. Throw in a bunch of guidance counselors who are bonused, not on their ability to get a kid into a trade school, but on their ability to get that kid into a four-year school. And you just have a witch's brew of bullcrap. And all of that has added up over the years. But we're turning the tanker around, and you can see it in the numbers. You can see Gen Z, a big chunk of them. Articles like the one in the Journal not long ago called The Tool Belt Generation. These guys are getting it. They're doing the math, and they're realizing that starting a career, $300,000 in the hole, you're not going to get out of the hole, maybe ever. So, look, the other thing that's happening is, in my world anyway, not a week goes by where I don't hear from some big institution, some big company, some big organization who is, this will sound hyperbolic, but the words are desperate and panicked. They're desperate and they're panicked, Brian, because the workers aren't there. And I just said this on the couch down there at Fox and Friends 10 minutes ago. You've probably forgotten already, so let me repeat it.
Short-term memory loss. If Trump, too many head balls.
If Trump's right, if he reshores, I'm rooting for him, he's going to create between 1 and 2 million manufacturing jobs. Awesome. What about the 500,000 open manufacturing jobs right now that employers can't fill? What are we going to do? Obama did the same thing in 2009, Highway Infrastructure Act, talked about 3 million shovel-ready jobs. But he was talking to a country who was not terribly enthused about the prospect of picking up a shovel. And so you run in to a really fundamental problem, and it's a workforce problem, and nobody wants to talk about it because it's just not that flattering for the country.
Well, I'll tell you, put some upward pressure. I think that's the right term, and that is there's so many kids who are choosing not to work, floating through society. There's too many people who are not disabled. Whether it's whatever it is, they're choosing not to work, and they can get by with the social safety net. That's got to stop. At the same time, I also believe that we should get work visas in to get people legally here to work and establish themselves. That's a way to find almost a trial run for citizenship.
Do me a favor. There's an economist who you would love, and I think he would come in here and talk to you. His name is Nicholas Eberstadt. He wrote a book called Men Without Work back in 2005. Republished it, reprinted it during the lockdowns because everything he wrote about came true. But at its heart, Nick is talking about 7.2 million able-bodied men in working age who are not only not working, but not looking for work, affirmatively not looking for work. That's never happened mm-hmm. before, not in peacetime anyway. And so that is another metric. That's why I don't just talk about the skills gap. It's real.
It's a will gap.
That's real too.
Right. I want you to hear this clip, and I played it on a part of it in TV, but I think this is what Scott Bessent said in your seat before he was Treasury Secretary. He's a rich guy worth $500 million. And I asked, what's your greatest concern? Why do you want to be Treasury Secretary? And he said, what's your number one focus? He goes, the wage gap. He goes, what do you mean? There's too many rich people and there's too many poor people and the middle class's wage is not growing. And that is going to cause a civil war in this country if we don't fix it. For a guy worth $500 million, that's why I knew he was the right guy.
Yeah.
But this is what encouraged him and why he thought Trump was the right guy. Cut three.
I was out on the campaign trail with President Trump. I was struck by there had been a big migration by the venture capital community, President Trump. So on one side, you've got the VCs, the most innovative people in the world. You got Elon Musk, the richest person in the world. And the president's penultimate rally that I went to was in Pittsburgh. These steelworkers showed up, and they got their vest on, they got their hard hats, they got their families. The real idea is to make sure that innovators can innovate and steelworkers can have the same quality of life and opportunity, and that you know their kids could be the Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, or they can stay and have the same life or better that their folks had in Pittsburgh.
And that really encompasses why Trump ran.
Yeah.
He likes the working class, knows the elite. And in this time, they both came together. Last time, they're like, this guy's not going to win. He's not worthy. You know, he's too much of a showman to be a rich guy. He's not one of the cool rich guys.
Yeah.
And the rich don't really like him. This time, they go, listen, I saw what the last 4 years were. They vilified us.
Yep. So I got this podcast. It's called The Way I Heard It. You've been on it. You were great. The current episode features two CEOs of two companies in this country who have been making stuff here exclusively. One is Josh Smith up at the Montana Knife Company. The other is Bayard Winthrop over at American Giant. One makes sweatshirts. The other makes knives. I really wanted to hear, because I haven't really heard from many people who've truly bet on our country and put their money where their mouth is over the last decade or so. These guys are like, what supply chain problem? They are utterly unaffected by the tariffs. And it seems an obvious thing to say, but when you hear them talk about the fact that all of these things in the headlines simply don't apply to them because they never signed the paper that made them fundamentally reliant on a country who, frankly, kind of hates us, right? They just didn't want to do it. So, again, they're not taking a victory lap, but I think it's really important for the country to hear from people mm-hmm. who didn't buckle under the pressure to offshore. That's not to say that the people who did are in any way subordinate or made a mistake. It's just that at the core of this whole conversation, Brian, we have to figure out, are we really having an economic conversation about what's best for the country, short or midterm? Or are we having a conversation about something that just might be more important than the economy? And people freak out when I say that because they're like, well, what could be more important than the economy? Well, I got news for you. 170 years ago, The Economist and our country and a lot of other smart people said it would be insane to get rid of slavery. It would break the economy, might even lead us to a war. But the winds blew the way they blew, and we came to the conclusion that we were talking about something that was actually more important to our country, more important to our identity. And when I look at China today, and when I look at the Uyghurs, and when I look at the lab leak, and when I look at, man, when I look at the organ harvesting that's happening there, these guys have built hospitals next to prisons, and they estimate 70,000 to 100,000 hearts and livers and kidneys have been sold from prisoners, mm-hmm. right? So it's like, it's best to look squarely at the people we rely upon and then decide, right? Because it might be more important in the long term to not rely upon them.
And we got our wake-up call during the pandemic. Let's be awake. Let's stay awake.
Yeah.
And the president doesn't work to his benefit now to bring up that stuff, but that is the story because he's still got to negotiate an exit. Apple's got to get out of there. Soon they're going to be making more in India than ever. Like to bring him here, but not enough engineers. Steve Jobs wrote about that right now. Yep. Hopefully we can make that happen. You have to run, but everyone should know about your brand new show.
It's
called People You Should Know.
Correct.
It is on YouTube.
Yep.
And Mike Works Foundation also gives an opportunity for people that want to get into the trades.
I got $3 million in this round of scholarships. It's open for another few days, microworks.org. Mm-hmm. If you want to learn a skill that's in demand, go get some money.
All right. Micro, thanks for not dressing up. I wouldn't recognize you. All right.
Ditto.
This is exactly. I did dress.
I'm not wearing any pants.
Which was your option? I didn't think you'd take it. We put it on the ticket, but I didn't think you'd do it. And by the way, the driver we sent over was a little offended.
I bet he was.
Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, I'm Trey Gowdy, host of the Trey Gowdy Podcast. I hope you will join me every Tuesday and Thursday as we navigate life together and hopefully find ourselves a little bit better on the other side.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Yeah, welcome back, everyone. I went a little long with Mike Rowe because I got a million and one things to talk about. It says, as he ends a sentence, I think about three of the topics. That's what's so great about him. You know, he used to be like that Geraldo when he used to come on, but nobody's like Mike Rowe, and he's got that special out on everyday people. So he's a big celebrity who loves hanging out with everyday people. So I'm going to be talking to Lieutenant Colonel Alan West about this. I love this idea of offering free rides and $1,000 to illegal immigrants that want to go home. Essentially saying, guys, I'm going to get to you sooner or later. Why don't you make it easy and go the right way? And if you go the right way and you make it easy for us, I make it easy for you by giving you the ride. You don't have to walk. Number two is you don't have to worry about being arrested. Number three is you get $1,000. And you have in good stead as you reapply to come back, if that's what you want to do. And I think it makes sense. People think that that shows a desperation on Trump's part. I go, not at all. Because we don't hate people that came here illegally. A lot of them have the best motivation in mind. You just can't do it. You broke the law. Can't allow it. So how do we fix it without people feeling resentful? I think this is a good way. Not everyone's going to do it, but I think it's good. I'll talk to Lieutenant Colonel Alan West about that.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
We're going to pay each one a certain amount of money, and we're going to get them a beautiful flight back to where they came from, and they have a period of time. And if they make it, we're going to work with them so that maybe someday, with a little work, they can come back in if they're good people, if they're the kind of people that we want in our company, industrious people that could love our country.
So that is, by the way, I assume it's not going to be, I think it's going to be a beautiful flight. So I assume it's not going to be JetBlue and it's not going to be out of Newark. But what the president is offering, The president is offering a ride home for illegal immigrants who got here illegally, were staying here, and assumingly didn't commit a crime. And look, we're going to get you sooner or later, so why don't you self-deport, if I could steal a phrase from Mitt Romney. And I think it's good. By the way, if you look at the breakdown, it saves money between the arrest, between capturing, between transporting them, and that's safer for them. And also, I'm sure it's going to be easier to say, hey, I self-deported. I'd like to reapply the right way to my embassy and try to get back here. And if you look at immigration reform, which could happen once the border's secure, maybe somebody that left on their own, didn't commit any crimes when they were here, will get favorable treatment. I would not be against that. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West joins us, Dallas County Republican Party Chair, American Constitutional Rights Union Executive Director. Colonel, welcome back. Your thoughts about the self-deport move?
Well, it's good to be with you, Brian, and I don't have any problems with this proposal because, once again, you think about what Joe Biden did to these individuals. It was a false premise. He did not have the constitutional authority to grant them
these paroles. He just turned the other way.
He just turned the other way, and all these, you know, CBP apps and things of this nature. So, Donald Trump is coming and saying, we're going to restore the rule of law. We're going to restore our sovereignty, and we will allow you to return back to your country of origin. And then once we get our border in the right status and secure, and we get rid of the criminal legal immigrants, we will refine and we will review our legal immigration processes, and we will make it possible for you to apply in the right way to come back to the United States of America. Who could disagree with that stance?
Well, the thing is, too, is that you got to put pressure on all sides. Can't go to school. You can't get to a college if you don't have citizenship. You can't get a job with E-Verify if you don't have citizenship. You can't get a license if you don't have citizenship. And then after a while, people who said this is the chance of my lifetime to get to America, sadly, they were sold a wrong story. And that story ended in November. So they have to go. Simple as that. Okay, but I don't hate those people. You don't hate those people. They didn't commit crimes. They made a mistake. They came here because they were told that this was their moment because the border wall dropped, the veil dropped. So send them back. And if there might, you give them somewhat preferential treatment or slightly or not negative treatment for being caught, and then we fix this thing because we do need workers here.
Yes, we do. And I think this is about honor, integrity, and character. And people should realize, I did do wrong, regardless of the fact that I was falsely led to believe that I could come here and get all types of benefits and work and take advantage of American taxpayer resources. So, yes, they get the opportunity to return back. Once we get our country in the right shape, then they can apply and they can come back to this country and they can work. We can have a guest worker program, all of these different type of things that we once had here in the United States of America, all these people that say we need folks to work in agriculture. Well, let's figure out the means by which we can have people come here and work seasonably in agriculture, but they're accounted for and they are, they are not in the shadows and they're not abused and they can be tracked. And if they overstay a granted visa, then, they have, committed committed a felony against the United States of America, and they will not be allowed to return ever again. So I think that this is puts us on the right path.
If the Republicans keep the House and Senate and this border stays sealed and we're able to take the military off the border and it's still sealed, that is the groundwork needed for immigration reform, because there's a lot of things that we agree on, in terms of, keeping our first round draft picks that want to stay here and are the next Elon Musk that might be going to the University of Wisconsin. They have to go back. Well, maybe there's a chance we keep them here. The work visa program could need to be reformed. You marry someone from another country, the hoops you have to go through, the fines you got to pay, not the fines, but the fees you have to pay. Well, we could bring them down and make them more affordable. But until we get the illegal aspect out, we can't do it. So maybe we could get there under Trump, especially a guy that's term limited. I want to bring you to something else, and that's one thing I've talked to military and I've talked to people in the Trump administration. They're eyeing the cartels. They know that's where the fentanyl's coming from. They know where that's the trafficking's coming from, and it's not okay. And what I thought was interesting is CNN, and I'm not against this as a premise. I don't have a problem interviewing criminals, but the way CNN treated this criminal is so bizarre. This is Isabel Young, a reporter, interviewing a cartel member whose face is obscured. Cut 31.
According to the Trump administration, you are a terrorist. I mean, the cartels have been labeled a foreign terrorist organization. What do you make of that?
Well, the situation is ugly, but we have to eat.
What's your message to Donald Trump, if he's watching this?
My respect. According to him, he's looking out for his people. But the problem is, the consumers are in the United States. If there weren't consumers, we would stop.
Okay, it's very like the mindset of the mob. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I find it very offensive that this guy says that we have to eat. So that's the reason why we're going to flood your country with drugs. We're going to flood your country with, you know, human trafficking and sex trafficking. Look, we have a terrorist organization that is operating just on the other side of our border, no different from Hamas, Hezbollah, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Taliban. We have to deal with them in the right means because if Mexico wants to continue to allow them to have sanctuary within their country and they're going to continue to facilitate the deaths of Americans, we've got to deal with that. And I don't have any pity whatsoever on these cartel members, and I think that we need to start looking at the financial institutions here in the United States of America that support them, and we need to start, you know, freezing funds and freezing assets here in the United States of America, these individuals, and get tougher on them all along the border. So, yes, we need to have our military there because this is a non-state, non-uniform, belligerent actor, no different from the Houthis that are right there on the American border. And Texas has 1,254 miles that it shares with the country called Mexico and these cartels.
I want to bring it to your military background, and that is Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of Defense, is going to focus on now on four-star generals and our National Guard. You got some, he says we are way too heavy with generals and officers, huge salaries. He wants to put it into the warfighters. Can you bring me into the politics of the military, National Guard, four-star generals? I mean, why? What was their what is their focus, and can we do with less?
Well, I never served in the National Guard, but I think that we can do with less. We are very top-heavy in our United States military, and I think he has articulated that very well when you look at the ratio of generals to troops in World War II to where we are today. So I do think that we need to have more of the individuals that are out there doing the everyday tasks and purposes and less of the higher headquarters. Every time you turn around, we're creating another bureaucracy. I understand we have to have the combatant commands, but some of these combatant commands, SOCOM, PACOM, AFRICOM, CENTCOM, they have gotten so big that it's taken away from really the function of our military. After your one-star promotion, two-star, three-star, four-star, these are all political appointments, and I think that's something else we need to look at. You know, what type of generals do we have out there? Are these generals that are paying attention to honoring their oath to the Constitution, or are they becoming politicized generals? And I think that this is a great that 20% reduction of generals in the military, that's not going to kill us.
By the way, the IDF is now bombing Sana'a, in Yemen, after the Houthi rebel attack got into the Tel Aviv airport, beat all their Whipples, their missile defense systems. Now, on a separate note, the IDF is calling up their reserves, saying we're going into Gaza, we're going to go in and we're going to hold land. And every day that goes by that we don't get our hostages back, we're going to take more of it. How do you feel about this strategy?
There's only one way to deal with a terrorist organization, and that is with strength, and that's with might. They don't understand compromise, appeasement, and negotiation, and we should not be negotiating with Houthis, Hamas, Hezbollah, or any of these non-state belligerents that are attacking sovereign nation states. So they have the right to do what is necessary to protect their people and to protect their country and protect their interests all across the Middle East. So the United States, I think that with the Trump administration, Israel realized that they do have the ability to do exactly and take these actions. Would not have been able to do that under the Biden administration, definitely not with a Harris administration.
Right. Here's what Britt Hume said, Cut 42.
The president, of course, is coming to the Middle East. Our friends in the Middle East and the president himself obviously would like to have some progress toward the release of the hostages and the other remaining issues with Hamas. But that remains up in the air as well, with the possibility now existing that the Israelis are going to do what they stopped doing in 2005 when they got out of Gaza. They occupied the place, as you recall, Brett, for a long time, and the Israelis pulled out in 2005. That didn't stop Hamas from complaining bitterly about the continued occupation, which was no more. But here we are after all this, and it looks like Israel could be back in Gaza and taking charge of the place. Wow.
Yeah, and that's where we're at right now, and there's no talk scheduled. And the president just said, I'm going to try to get some aid into the civilians, but the IDF have at it. That's what Petraeus said early on. He said, the one thing about the IDF, you can't just go in, you have to hold. Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely agree. And, you know, Brigham is right. 2005, under I think it was Ariel Sharon, Israel completely left Gaza Strip and turned it over. And who came in and filled that vacuum, that void? Hamas. And they're the governing authority there. And all they have done is rain down terror on Israel. So Israel tried to do the right thing. And for the past, 20 years, they have been met with heinous attacks, which culminated in October the 7th. So they have to clean house and they have to get rid of Hamas. Hamas cannot be the governing authority in the Gaza Strip territory.
All right. And if you look at ISIS and Al-Qaeda, it is possible to neutralize. Although I'm reading that Afghanistan is now an Al-Qaeda hotbed again, and they're selling our weapons that we left behind for maximum profit. That's a big story out today. Lieutenant Colonel West, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Brian.
All right, 1-866-408-7669. On the other side, I'll be able to take your calls. Right now, Hamas has also made an announcement. The bombing's happening right this moment. They said we will no longer engage in any hostage talks as long as Israel continues to bomb Gaza. Unbelievable. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Harvard's had a big problem with anti-Semitism. It's got a big problem with too many progressives relative to the number of conservatives. It's had a big problem of paying too much attention to identity politics.
But Summers says Trump is not trying to reform Harvard in good faith. He says the president wants to break it.
The laws say you have to have hearings. The laws say you have to give notice. The laws don't say you can engage in extortion. And when you simply cut off all funding based on a set of conditions, that's extortion.
No, it isn't. Match the conditions. That's Larry Summers. And that's it. And you want to take Harvard's side? Go ahead. I'm not. And most of America is not. Yale? You know you're under scrutiny and you still have an anti-Semitic riot that stops Jewish kids from going to their finals. And at the same time, they had Columbia. They panicked last week on Thursday or Friday. They were going to have encampments again on the campus. You can't control these people. And then it turns out in Yale's case, you actually had faculty organizing it. So now you wonder why Trump's coming down hard, because he came down on Harvard. You know what they said? We're suing you. Well, now you got it. Now you're no longer a nonprofit status. Now sue to try to get it back and then go ahead. You did your own study and it turns out that 65% or 75% of your Jewish students don't feel safe on campus. And Randy Fine was on this show saying when he went to school, 20% of the campus was Jewish. Now it's 5 and most don't feel secure. You're going to lose this fight. And public sentiment is not for Harvard and Yale. I hate to tell you, especially because we're not going to bat. Yeah, every time they come down and say, we're going to withhold funds, they go, well, I guess we're not going to be able to cure cancer. Excuse me? Number one, I'd like to know, and the answer might be overwhelmingly great, and I hope it is. I'd like to know what your studies are yielding. I would also like an accountability where the money's going. How many scientists have been hired? How long are these studies? How many trips are you taking with the money coming from, infinite amount of money coming from the government? I'm talking about billions. Listen to Bill Ackman, a self-made multi-billionaire, cut 16, Harvard grad on CNBC.
Fair or unfair to try to take the tax exempt status away?
I think it's fair. Again, Harvard became, over time, a political advocacy organization for one party. When a university goes from being a university to, you know, affecting the, you know, becoming a political advocacy organization. It doesn't deserve nonprofit status. I mean, and they have to. Harvard should be a place where students go to learn and the best research gets done. It shouldn't be a place that is allowing, you know, pro-terrorist organizations on campus, that only allows, you know, certain kinds of thinking and speech on campus. You know, that's a political advocacy organization. It's not a university.
And you're not going to straighten out. And this is it. I think that if you ask President Trump what's wrong with these Ivy League institutions and college campuses, and most conservatives, most Republicans, let's say even moderates, say that these campuses have become haven for liberal, extreme liberal views, the extreme green movement, the extreme, what used to be extreme anti-Vietnam movement, whatever it was, it made sense. It was American policy. Now you're going to advocate for Middle Eastern oppressive organizations no more for terror than settlements that don't want any peace, and they have a terrible history in this country. And now you find a group that's financed from outside perspectives who are looking to riot against our allies, a democracy in the Middle East looking to respond to an October 7th massacre. So now you say, okay, I have a huge problem with your anti-Semitism. And I got something else. I have a huge problem with your anti-Americanism. And on something else, I have a problem with your faculty. And your faculty proudly is way to the left. Your faculty has made it impossible to be a conservative on your campus. Your faculty has destroyed the reputation of your school. And although most people want to walk around and say, I'm from Harvard, I'm from Yale, I'm from Princeton, you have sullied the reputation of these elite universities. It goes back hundreds of years. On the other side, Larry Summers thinks it's a horrible thing. Well, please tell me another way that you could get reform on these campuses rapidly. The anti-Semitism required a massive response that Joe Biden refused to make. This president's different, and he told you he was going to be different. He told you he was not going to put up with these riots, the harassment of Jews to Jewish students just because they're Jewish, the demand of universities divest from another country and organizations with funds that students should have nothing to do with. You don't like the way a college invests? Go to a different college. The next one, University of Washington, riots yesterday against Jewish kids and against Israel. Your time's coming. And Harvard, the more you fight, the worse you look, because the country's not with you. Believe me.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. I'm Brian Kilmeade. Thanks so much for being here. We're going to talk Medicaid. I know it doesn't sound like the sexiest thing, but it might make or break the big, beautiful bill. Barney and Company will do a simulcast on FPN. That'll be fascinating. And Paul Winfrey's going to be with us to break it down for the Wall Street Journal. And he talks about what's really at stake. And look, people want the bill to pass, but I want Medicaid and Medicare fixed. That's why Dr. Oz is so perfect to be there. And what happened that caused it to overflow? What caused it to go into the red? What caused all the abuse? In my view, Obamacare. I'll explain. Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
They keep circling back to the same narrative that there was nothing to see there. And then all of a sudden, the American people got to see it on the debate stage. And what we're seeing now is them trying to rewrite history.
Perhaps that's what Mark Meadows says. Dems' civil unrest continues as they wrestle with an old guard who doesn't want to get out, for even up to 83-year-old James Clyburn and 80-something-year-old Steny Hoyer. And guess who else is there? Nancy Pelosi. And then meanwhile, the cover-up of the former president, who was way too old to be president, is chronicled again and still being denied, but in two new books.
Number two.
We've just made it abundantly clear until they can come on board and fight anti-Semitism, obey the laws that the Supreme Court have put in place. Their answer to us was filing a lawsuit on freedom of speech. That is not the issue. It's a civil rights issue on campus.
Harvard slammed face first into the turnbuckle by Linda McMahon. And I don't think anyone's coming out of the locker room to save them. We look at Trump's war on anti-Semitic elite education.
Number one.
There's an opportunity here that if we can do it, the goal on one side, I call it reprivatizing the government or reprivatizing the U.S. economy. By the time President Trump leaves office, we're back at the long-term average of about 3.5% deficit to GDP.
There you go. Scott Bessent weighs in, showing strength. Bessent shined on the Milken stage, and the world was watching as the markets rose, and they're pretty solid right now and have been for the past 10 days. We need some trade deals, and their indications are they could come this week. And I think this is going to be really important. Number one, big story about China. Tomorrow there's going to be a press conference, very little notice. They talk about different stimuluses for their economy, for their manufacturing section. Now, they're a top-secret authoritarian society that doesn't even publish fake numbers these days. Even though their goal is to get 5% GDP growth for an emerging country like that with a huge workforce, that's what's accepted if you're to believe that number. I don't think they're going to get close, and it has a lot to do with the trade battle they're in with us as we try to balance out trade once and for all. So look for indications there. China also, big story in the Wall Street Journal today, that they don't have control of their military. They've fired a series of high-ranking officers, including the number two guy in charge of the army. I mean, President Xi's got huge problems with an army that gets bigger, more sophisticated, but they are not battle-tested. And evidently, they're not following orders too well. So there's a lot of friction with that country that's not being well reported just because it's communist and that's the way they do things. So Scott Bessent, I thought, was very impressive in the speech that I saw and some of the give and take that he was able to handle at the Milken Institute, which is where these elites go to talk about the next generation of innovation, whether it's economics or AI or things to that nature. Here's the Treasury Secretary, cut to.
As I've said before, there's an opportunity here that if we can do it, the goal on one side, I call it reprivatizing the government or reprivatizing the U.S. economy. On one side, we want to bring down government borrowing slowly, maybe decrease the deficit by 1% a year. So by the time President Trump leaves office, we're back at the long-term average of about 3.5% deficit to GDP, and the denominator grows faster than the numerator. Debt to GDP goes down. So we're decreasing the government in the economy. At the same time, we are right-sizing government spending.
And that will help balance out what we're doing right now. And what he's trying to do is this. He's trying to recalibrate in real time, massive amount of trade deals, and start to bring our own products back here to be made, whether it's cars or garments, when it's possible. And they talk to someone in the garment business. They say it's going to be impossible. Get most of our stuff from Vietnam now and Southeast Asia. That's our business model. And those are people that will have trouble bringing things back. But then if the tariff goes up, the price goes up, maybe it would make sense to come back here. But what China's saying is, they said that they're reading every day. This is what he was saying about China. He's reading every day what's happening with factories. From the epidemic point, he says right now they have a history of trade battles. They're a deficit country. The surplus country always has the most to lose because we're the deficit country. If you're used to flooding things into a market and that market shuts down or gets too costly, they pay the price. We could choose not to buy. He says they need to see more gestures from China before we're going to approach them. One gesture I thought was going to be enough when they said they're going to visit the precursors to fentanyl. I thought that might be able to knock off the 20% on the tariffs that might give them an opening to come to the table. But I know they have to do it the right way. And we got to make sure this is the right deal. Just like when it comes to military and security, the same thing with Iran. Here's the president yesterday, cut one.
We're going to have a big announcement next week on some of this kind of thing, but more related to costs, the costs of medicines and drugs, because we're being ripped off, as you know, very badly being ripped off compared to the rest of the world.
Mr. President, on the pharmaceutical side, have you made any determination on kind of what those tariff rates may look like and the timing of those?
I have. I'll announce it over the next 2 weeks.
Yeah. Pharmaceutical prices, does anybody think they're just right? Looking to bring them back. He's looking to make sense of it. He also wants exposure for it. So we'll see where this tariff thing goes. It was the focus, but I noticed more and more people are more and more level-headed about where we're heading next. It's going to be very interesting in an hour Mark Carney, the new prime minister of Canada, who ran as anti-Trump candidate. He's going to stare down Trump and the unfair things they say we're doing. Don't like the 51st state talk. I don't really love it either. But Mark Carney says, I got to go visit America. Why? Because he knows they depend on all their trade and manufacturing with us in this relationship. You can't sit there and have a good economy. He's an accountant by trade and without us. And he's got to work it out. And the tough guy thing might be good to get elected, but it's not going to work in the Oval Office. I can't wait to see the tone he gives. Here's the president yesterday, cut 11.
What's your expectation for your meeting with the Canadian prime minister tomorrow?
I don't know. He's coming to see me. I'm not sure what he wants to see me about, but I guess he wants to make a deal. Everybody does. They all want to make a deal because we have something that they all want. We have something that they all want.
He went on to say they want access to the markets. They want to be able to sell their products here. He says we shouldn't be buying lumber there. Here's the prime minister yesterday. Cut 12.
We're meeting as heads of our government to discuss that partnership. Now, I'm not pretending those discussions will be easier. They won't proceed in a straight line. There'll be zigs and zags, ups and downs. But as I said in my remarks, I will fight for the best deal for Canada and only accept the best deal for Canada and take as much time that's necessary.
Right. We'll see how the tone is, because we know that if he starts with an attitude, the president's going to come right back at him and he's going to have Lutnick on the couch. He's maybe Bessent, but I think that he's got to testify today. Probably Lutnick. I imagine the vice president will be there. I don't know if the secretary of state would be there. Yeah, I think so, because he's national security advisor, too. And they'll be around and they'll do their meeting. And this is one of those times when the press comes in and they're both together. I think they're both going to get questions relevant to his appearance from Canada, because Canada, like China, were the one that refused to put the few to do reciprocal tariffs back at us and react. And he said, don't overreact. We kind of ignored Canada reacting and focused on China, but it was so important. So I got to talk about Harvard. So yesterday, Linda McMahon took action. We came down and we said we're going to be holding back billions of dollars from Harvard as we examine the anti-Semitism on campus and what is actually going on there. And they said, we're going to hold back that, and we're also going to re-examine your tax-exempt status. And they came back and they got some lawyers and they sued, suing President Trump. Things going kind of quiet. I don't know the wisdom of suing the Trump administration. When you want grants and you want to make sure you keep the tax-exempt status, which means you're apolitical. Nobody thinks that Harvard, Yale, Princeton and Columbia are apolitical. And certainly they got a huge problem with anti-Semitism on their campus. So yesterday, Linda McMahon took action. She talked about it with Larry Kudlow, cut 14.
We've just made it abundantly clear, until they can come on board and fight anti-Semitism, obey the laws at the Supreme Court, have put in place about the kind of admissions policies they should have, stop driving Jewish students, almost underground with their anti-Semitism and just many more things. And we've talked to them. Their answer to us was filing a lawsuit on freedom of speech. And I have said that is not the issue. It's a civil rights issue on campus relative to the anti-Semitism.
So what do you do with that? Linda McMahon came back, a scathing letter. There you go. Now you're losing it. Now they're going to say, well, now we can't research cancer, cerebral palsy. All these things are going to go scurvy. We're not going to be able to put ointment on people's rashes. All studying, all operations are going to stop. What about the construction of the school? What about the heating? What about the utilities? The money that comes from the government funds institutions like that, and now they took it for granted. And now they're suing, and now they're going to get hit back. The 501c3 status is also in jeopardy. She also has a recommendation, cut 15.
They've just said that we're trying to dictate to them how they should run their university, which is clearly not the case. But why should taxpayers continue to give money to a university that has an endowment of over $53 billion? It just doesn't make any sense, Larry. So the president's looking at their 501c3 status, and he wants them to come to the table and change things. I mean, Harvard was such a revered university, but it's not anymore. And what students are we letting in? What kind of background checks are we doing then? What kind of teachers are we letting in? Mm. I think about 3% of the faculty is conservative. The rest are not.
So, you know, what's interesting is that when she got this job, they said, well, I'm going to slowly wind down the education department and give it all to the states. And sooner or later, by the time I'm done, there'll be no more department. Well, she's been as busy as anybody in the cabinet. No question about it. Larry Summers, former president of Harvard, has taken action. He obviously on CBS, he has a huge problem with this. Cut 17.
Harvard's had a big problem with anti-Semitism. It's had a big problem with too many progressives relative to the number of conservatives. It's had a big problem of paying too much attention to identity politics.
But Summers says Trump is not trying to reform Harvard in good faith. He says the president wants to break it.
The laws say you have to have hearings. The laws say you have to give notice. The laws don't say you can engage in extortion. And when you simply cut off all funding based on a set of conditions, that's extortion.
I don't know what you mean by extortion, but he said flat out, these are, you know, we're going to freeze funding until you can do these things. I don't know why that's extortion. Do the things. And if you wanted to, if you had a problem with, for example, the most controversial thing is the curriculum. You know, these anti-Israeli courses that are offered in New York City, for example, the attitudes and some of the curriculum from some of these courses are really anti-American. If you look at their history, if you look at their history division, if you look at what they're doing with Middle Eastern studies, that's problematic. But it is also a problem with the government coming in saying, I don't like that, I don't like that, and I don't like that. So you could say, well, I'm free to do that. Fine. But if you are free to do that, then you're also free from federal funds. That's the pushback. Here's more from Larry Summers. Cut 18.
What do you say to an American who didn't go to the Ivy League and they think Harvard's a little biased toward the left? Why should they care about President Trump exerting pressure on major universities?
I would say they're right to worry about Harvard being a little tilted to the left. But I would also tell them that if we cut off funding for cancer research, cancer cures are going to come more slowly.
We'll see. There's got to be massive action. And sooner or later, they're going to realize that public sentiment is not in their corner. When we come back, we'll talk more about this. Also, bottom of the hour, we're going to look at the big, beautiful bill, the latest on there. And Paul Winfrey joins us, an economist and founder, as well as president and CEO of the Economic Policy Innovation Center in Washington, D.C. We want the bill to pass. I want the bill to pass. You should want the bill to pass. But I would love to see Medicaid be brought back into the original charter it was founded on and not just papered over because Barack Obama broke it with Obamacare. I'll explain when we come back.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I didn't see him again until White House Correspondents' Dinner weekend 2024. And I was at a White House reception. And he was bad. He was quite bad in it. And he told the same story twice. And he just seemed mostly old. Not in no way did I look at that and say, that man cannot do the job of president. I had real concerns that he could not do it for 4 more years. But he just, like, your concern, you look at that, if someone with my perspective is, man, that's a guy who's going to struggle on the campaign trail in a presidential campaign.
Dan Pfeiffer on Pod Save America. When is the last time that you saw somebody for a short period of time and they told you the same story twice? Think about that. Imagine looking at the president of the United States and he tells you the exact same story. Now, I read this in different places. I imagine it's separate appearances. He tells the audience the same story verbatim with the same pauses in a row. And now Dan Pfeiffer's saying a very similar story. He looked old. He looked bad. Okay, I don't know how he could campaign, but he didn't think he could do the job. I don't know. Do you watch him? We all knew he couldn't do the job. And you just say he said the same story twice and he imagines a short appearance, 20 minutes? That's insane to say the same story twice. Jen Psaki, cut 22.
I never saw that person, not a single time, and I was in the Oval Office every day, that was on that debate stage. I'm not a doctor. Aging happens quite quickly. were things that people saw during that period of time that were similar to that or would have been in a category of that? I don't know. Cover up is a very loaded term, I think.
Well, you have that to lean back on, that you lied and didn't tell the truth about the condition of Joe Biden, and that's going to come up. And then you, well, who's going to be the leader of the party? Well, somebody ages out and you do your term limited, you have to turn the page anyway. In his case, he lost, so you got to turn the page. Nobody wants to turn it back to Kamala Harris. They have this other simmering problem. Nobody wants to retire. You have James Clyburn got angry when asked yesterday, are you going to step aside at 83? He goes, well, you want to bring somebody? He goes, what do you want me to do? Give up on my life? All right, maybe think what Durbin said. It's time to make room for somebody else. And then AOC came out yesterday and said she's not going to seek the top spot in the oversight committee. He says, it's clear to me that the underlying dynamics in the caucus have not shifted with respect to seniority as much as I think would be necessary. So I believe I'll be staying in the energy committee. What he's trying to say is they're going for someone older. They're not going for the 30-something or 40-year-old. I don't know. It's not my problem, but you got to make room. Now, Crockett doesn't care. I mean, she's just throwing caution to the wind. She's going to try for that spot, and she's going to scream and yell if she doesn't get it, for sure.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
One of our top priorities this year is making the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act permanent. TCJA did a lot for small businesses. Lower tax rates, the 199A small business deduction, and bonus depreciation and other investment incentives lowered small businesses' tax burden and encouraged them to invest in themselves, hire more workers, and in turn grow our economy.
So it's really going to turn everything around. As the trade deals come in, people are keeping their eye on the big, beautiful bill. They say the House, that's the president named it, they say the House is probably going to be the closest to be done by Memorial Day, and they get everything done in the perfect world by July 4th. Can they get this done? Can they sustain the tax cuts from 2017, make them permanent, add some money to the defense budget, and do the no tax on tips, new tax on Social Security, and move forward? Well, one of the things that President Trump has kind of hamstrung the process in by saying, I can't touch entitlements, Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid. Well, is that indeed possible? And is that the right thing to do, especially because of the how warped Medicaid has become since the advent of Obamacare, where the federal government has written big checks to states in order to expand their Medicaid, those Medicaid recipients. And I think all but 10 states have accepted the free money. Obama leaves office, and the federal government's on the hook. Paul Winfrey co-wrote a column today I think is really important in the Wall Street Journal. He's an economist and founder, as well as president and CEO of the Economic Policy Innovation Center in Washington, D.C. Paul, thanks so much for joining us. For people who don't live this every day and don't have that economics degree, why do you think it's important for this bill to reform Medicaid and not stay away from it?
Look, the Medicaid program has grown dramatically since Obamacare expanded in 2014. But the reality is that it's grown even more over the last 5 years because the Democrats under the Biden administration have encouraged states to use financing loopholes to bring in all sorts of money and to use the Medicaid program as essentially an ATM to fund not just health care for healthy adults, but really to cover their own budget shortfalls. And so Medicaid is seen as this cash cow now by states where it's not really the traditional cost-sharing program where the federal government paid a portion of the costs and the states picked up the rest. Now the federal government's picking up the majority, if not all of the cost for the healthy population, and again, using these financing loopholes to fund illegal immigrants, health care, to shore up their own budgets and to do all these other things with it that have absolutely nothing to do with health care.
Which is nuts. You say right now, since Obamacare, the federal government pays $9 for every dollar of state aid spending on able-bodied working-age adults, compared with $1.33 for pregnant women and disabled children. The incentive pushes states to favor healthy adults over the vulnerable when it comes to enrollment and access to providers and better services. Stop me if I'm wrong. Wasn't Medicaid for those who didn't have insurance, that were economically distressed, or for people who physically couldn't work?
That's right. So Medicaid is intended and was intended when it was created in the 1960s for the most vulnerable among us. So pregnant moms, low-income kids, the disabled, people who can't work. And what Obamacare did was that it expanded it to the working-age adults without kids, the non-disabled healthy adults without kids. And they knew that states would be under financial pressure to expand Medicaid to that population. And so they gave them lots of financial incentives to cover the costs at the federal level to get states to pick it up. Well, states have taken them up on that offer, but there are also all of these, you know, again, these financial loopholes that run through the Medicaid program that have gotten completely out of control, that states have really abused and have been pushed on them over the last 4 years by the Biden administration, that make the Medicaid financing just, I mean, it's just ripe for reform. If Congress doesn't take this opportunity to reform the program, then we quite literally are that much closer to a single payer system that they have in Europe and Canada right now.
Which nobody's happy with, the performance.
Right.
And you might say, well, I have health care. But if you ask people who have it, they all hate it. You ask people in Canada, they hate it. You ask people in England, they hate it. And that's where we're getting to. So all but 10 states took the offer from Obamacare, right? How are those 10 states doing that didn't accept the free money from the federal government?
Those 10 states all have budgets that are much more in line with their actual expenditures. But the problem is that the hospitals and the healthcare insurers are really lobbying those state governments. And I mean, who are we talking about here? South Carolina, Texas, Florida, and others who have resisted the Medicaid expansion. And what they're telling them is that because of these financing loopholes that were opened up during the Biden administration and that Trump has been slow to close, if you get on the bandwagon now and expand Medicaid, you're leaving money on the table. And that's true. But again, if they take this up, all it's going to do is enrich the hospitals, enrich the insurers, bring in that money and push us closer to a single payer system, which was the Democrats' plan all along, which is why we shouldn't be rewarding states that, you know, did the right thing when Obamacare tried to expand coverage 10 years ago.
So what do you think, for example, do you think the president would just say, don't touch Medicaid, don't touch Medicare, don't touch Social Security? That's my fear. Because they all need to be reformed. And what Democrat or Republicans say, if you want us to keep the House, do not give them a talking point of it's the Republicans who took health care away from the needy in Medicaid. And you know that's how it's going to be messaged. So how do you finesse your way through this?
That's right. So right now, like the way the current program works, because as you said, states make more money by not just expanding coverage to the able-bodied childless adults, but they also are able to cover more of the shortfall and the cost of covering them throughout their entire lives. That's where all of the focus in the healthcare system and the coverage expansions go at the state level. What it means in practice is while states are expanding healthcare for the able-bodied population, the vulnerable population's on wait lists. In almost every state, there is a waiting list for home healthcare for the disabled population. And if we continue to go down this road, that's going to be healthcare for everybody that's on Medicaid. Right now, there are almost 80 million people who are on the Medicaid program. As you know, and as your listeners know, that's the way that single payer works in Canada and in Europe. You have to ration some way. The way they ration is through waiting lists and shortages. That is the future unless we shore up the financing system. So what we've been telling the White House, I actually have a meeting with the White House in about 20 minutes on this, and I think the president generally understands this. But what we've been saying is that unless you fix the Medicaid financing system for the whole population, and specifically for the healthy population, you are going to threaten care for the vulnerable people. And that's the last thing that I think anybody should want.
It's interesting that the White House has you in there. You say congressional Republicans should tackle the core reasons for Medicaid growth. They should start by eliminating Medicaid's discrimination against the most vulnerable, like you mentioned, and lowering Obamacare 90% reimbursement rate for able-bodied adults. Then they should follow Biden's advice and eliminate the Medicaid provider tax scam. These reforms would generate significant savings. What is that, the generate provider tax scam, the Medicaid provider tax scam?
Oh, this is absolutely bonkers. This would be illegal if the private sector did it. Basically, what the Medicaid provider tax scam is that states tax Medicaid providers and then immediately give them subsidies to make up the amount of the tax that they just charged them. They then bill the federal government for the amount of the subsidy. And so they get back $9 for every $1 that they spend on the healthy population that's taxed, and they get $1.33 for every dollar that they spend on the vulnerable population. And then they take that money and they use it to fund budget shortfalls. They use it to, you know, install sprinkler systems in front of Gavin Newsom's, mansion in California. They use it to provide, you know, health care for illegal immigrants in California and New York. They do all sorts of things with it. But it's literally just a money laundering scam that the states are behind.
So, you know what? I know that's not your job, but messaging, communication should be in your meeting, too, because they need to message this correctly for the non-economists. So they don't niche it and say, you know, President Trump doesn't like poor people. That would be the headline. But you make so much sense. I really encourage everyone to read your column in today's Wall Street Journal. Paul Winfrey, good luck in your meeting today. And thanks for doing
this. Thank you for having me.
You got it. Back in a moment. We'll do some with Barney and Company, then take your calls. Don't move.
Now, the Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney & Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back. Listen, you know how it works. I have a little bit of time on the other end after Stuart Varney's done to squeeze in some calls if that's what you want. Also, I'll read some emails that are pouring in now. I think the Canadian Prime Minister is going to come to the White House. I think this could be a Zelensky-like meeting if this guy doesn't show respect. I mean, he really ran as being anti-Trump, not being afraid of Trump. If he comes out and just has an attitude towards the president, I don't know if you've seen him before, you've met him. He's not going to hold back. When those cameras are rolling, he's not going to look weak. And I think he's going to point out the imbalance on trade. So let's listen.
All right, it is precisely 10:51 Eastern Time, Kilmeade time by any other name. Brian, President Trump announced the 2027 NFL draft will be held on the National Mall. I'm told that more than 1 million people could attend. Is that accurate? A million people?
I don't know if you saw, Stuart. I know how busy you are. But in Green Bay, they had hundreds of thousands there for 3 days. I mean, literally for 3 days. And as much as I hated it to see it leave New York, which was so convenient, it has become such a spectacle. The NFL has built. The off-season is fascinating. Now we have the combines where we find out who the best prospects are. And the actual draft itself has become an event. And even the people that admit do the introductions is interesting. And then people who represent that town, that city, they come out first. And that's always interesting when it happens. And now you got the President of the United States who says, why don't you take the Washington Mall where so many historic things have happened? And you got Jefferson on one end, Lincoln on the other. And now the Redskins, excuse me, I'm stopping myself. Let me correct myself. The Commanders are actually good. And the owner is actually better and sane. So he is going to be a huge asset there. So I think with the commissioner, with the owner, with the president, I think it's going to be a major event. And keep in mind, too, RFK Stadium just got greenlighted. That was also part of the announcement. And guess who's his HHS secretary? His son. And I think that's going to be cool to bring. And Brett Baer would be better to talk to you about this than anybody else because he's the biggest Redskins fan around. That'd be great to bring back because not many people felt comfortable where the other stadium was. They want to see it back in the city.
Okay. The NFL's big time winning.
And don't forget the next FIFA case. World Cup.
Yes.
Right. Today, they're making an announcement.
Yeah, that's right. Education Secretary Linda McMahon says Harvard is no longer eligible for new federal research grants. Watch this.
The president, he even said the other day, hey, why would a university that would hire Bill de Blasio and Lori Lightfoot to do municipal government management?
Can you imagine? Can you? In the middle of this whole discussion, they hired those two?
Yep.
Professor de Blasio? Yep. Honestly?
So he's just really looking at this very closely because he thinks it's unfair to the American taxpayer to be subsidizing this.
Brian, I don't care about unfair to the American taxpayer for subsidizing it. I'm just interested in them appointing Bill de Blasio as a professor and Lori Lightfoot. I don't know whether that was the title, professor, but to have those two mayors appointed by Harvard to teach, to me, is extraordinary.
Right. They ran both cities into the ground. So if the name of the course is How to Run Your City Into the Ground, they are the perfect person. You know, how to take a city that was thriving with a huge potential and a wonderful history and just do everything wrong. That's the perfect Lightfoot and de Blasio. It sounds like a law firm you don't want representing you. So I do think that's a disaster. But I also think that Linda McMahon took on this fight, and I love it. And Bill Ackman came in, the Harvard grad, multi-billionaire, also defending it. Here's the problem. Anti-Semitism, anti-Americanism, elitism that thrives on that campus, anti-conservatism, pro-green world. They are in a bubble. They thought they wanted to fight back against Trump. They're going to go sue Trump to bring more scrutiny on their abhorrent behavior, thinking the American public's going to rally behind Harvard? Please. There's enough resentment already towards the Ivies and the arrogance that comes with it. And even Larry Summers, who tries to defend Harvard and get their money back, opens up his defense. He's the former president there and Treasury Secretary by saying, oh, yeah, they got anti-Semitism and there is no conservatives on campus. Well, then you don't get a 501c3 nonprofit status because that means you got a bias. Good luck. You will lose that fight.
You are right, Brian Kilmeade. Brian, thanks so much indeed. I just want to read Harvard, their statement as they responded. And they're saying, look, we received another letter from the administration doubling down on demands that would impose unprecedented and improper control over Harvard University and would have chilling implications for higher education. Today's letter makes new threats.
All right, we are clear. I wasn't sure. He said he wanted to read the letter, so I didn't know. He didn't lock me out. So I apologize for that. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to go over it again because if you're still listening to me from 20 minutes ago, I don't want to play the same sound bites over again. But I do love this fight with Harvard. So the president, when he talks about education, he's already addressing it. He's trying to get school choice everywhere. It's happening in the Republican states. And in some other states where the teachers' unions are very strong, even in Republican states, in Texas, they're starting to open it up now. I love the idea of giving federal funds to religious schools, too, because fundamentally, I know there's a difference between church and state, and that might be a constitutional question that could be tackled. But fundamentally, I see all these Catholic institutions, these Catholic schools going under, and it's a helpless feeling because it's run in many cases on donations. And all these other schools from charter schools on down are getting help in a time in which education's not for profit. I would love to see it sustain itself and be an option for people that don't want public school, where the public schools are terrible because your school taxes are low. What is school because your property taxes are low? What are property taxes for? A big bulk of the property taxes go to your schools. Well, if you don't live in a great area, your taxes are low. The schools get less financing. I'd love to be able to tell that family you got three options now. But the anti-Semitism, as horrific as it is, offers an opportunity that Republican president has been waiting for decades, an opportunity to attack higher education and try to make it a fair and balanced experience. Or how about a 60-40 experience and ban anti-Semitism and fight it every step of the way? Footage last night of riots at the University of Washington. Why? Because they don't like that university is investing with Israel. And they were demanding divestiture. Well, now you got the spotlight. You got the magnifying glass. I wonder how much money you're getting from the federal government. I know Trump's wondering, too. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you are.
Sports
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here. Thanks so much for listening. Our chance to talk about what's happening around the country and, of course, take your calls when possible. But this half hour, we're going to talk to Tristan Harris, co-founder and of the Center for Humane Technology. She's going to be here. He's going to be here. In fact, he's in studio right now. You can see him on the Fox Nation stream, which you could also get on BrianKilmeadeShow.com. We're also watching what's happening with the U.S. and Canada. The prime minister, after winning an election, comes to town. We know Trump's been trolling with saying, hey, how about the 51st state? You don't have to be a country. Talk about the trade relationship. They're not happy with the tariffs. Is this going to be a Zelensky scene in the Oval Office, or are they going to make peace and talk dollars and cents? We'll see. And before we get to Tristan, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
They keep circling back to the same narrative that there was nothing to see there. And then all of a sudden, the American people got to see it on the debate stage. And what we're seeing now is them trying to rewrite history.
That is the former chief of staff for Donald Trump. Talking about what's happening with the condition of Joe Biden over 4 years. Two more books are now out. Also, frustration among the Democrats that the old guard is not moving out. Today, AOC came out and said, I'm not going for the Oversight Committee. Clearly, the old guard does not want the new guard to come in. So they got to work out their civil war.
Number two.
We've just made it abundantly clear until they can come on board and fight anti-Semitism, obey the laws at the Supreme Court. Have put in place. Their answer to us was filing a lawsuit on freedom of speech. That is not the issue. It's a civil rights issue on campus.
And a strongly leaded word is kind of to strong action. Linda McMahon, Harvard, slammed hard by the Secretary of Education. I don't think anyone's coming into the out of the locker room to help them out. We're going to look at Trump's war on anti-Semitism on elite education.
Number one.
There's an opportunity here that if we can do it, the goal on one side, I call it reprivatizing the government or reprivatizing the U.S. economy. By the time President Trump leaves office, we're back at the long-term average of about 3.5% deficit to GDP.
There you go. Showing strength. Scott Bessin shined on the Milken stage as the markets rise. A lot of CEOs and higher-ups were in attendance. What we need to do now is to cut some trade deals. And China is now showing that they have a press conference tomorrow to talk about different things they're doing to kind of goose their economy, which is really top secret. They're showing less and less. They're not even showing inaccurate numbers these days. We're always great to have Tristan Harris with us, co-founder of the Center for Humane Technology. You remember Tristan first came into public notice and got a huge response when he was on Social Dilemma. Were you producing that too?
Didn't produce it, but it was based on our work at the Center for Humane
Technology. Right, because you were really concerned about the direction of our social media.
Exactly.
And it's even worse than now most people. In the beginning, you were exposing. Don't you find that most people on board now?
Well, I think anybody who's
people,
seen—
not engineers.
Yeah, the people, not the companies. I mean, I think the issue, you know, what I'm here to do is say, how do we learn the lessons from social media? You know, we made this really big mistake. We were super optimistic and thought about the possible, connecting people, giving everyone a voice. But we missed the probable of how the incentives of social media would take us in a certain direction. And just a few weeks ago, I gave a TED talk on the TED stage in Vancouver about how I'm here because I want us to not make that mistake with AI. And I think with AI, it's very seductive to get, you know, entranced by the possible, all the abundance that it can create, all the efficiencies, all the benefits that it gets that we all want. And you and I want, I have a beloved with cancer right now. We want those cancer drugs and all those benefits as soon as possible. But are we currently releasing AI in a way that we're going to get those benefits? Because we currently are caught in a race to roll out, a race to recklessness, which turns into basically a race to take shortcuts, a race not to secure the model. So China, no matter how far we are, they can steal the models very easily. And also a race to release this technology before we know how to control it. Because, Brian, one of the things people don't really get about AI is that it's unlike all other kinds of technology and engineering. If you want to make a small airplane into a big airplane, like a 747, you have to know more about engineering and aerodynamics, right? If you want to make a small building into a really big building, you have to know more about construction and safety engineering. When you want to make an AI 10 times more powerful, you don't have to know more about how to control it. You just sort of put it more data and more computers working on it, and you go from GPT-2, which couldn't count to 10, to GPT-4, which, you know, or GPT-03, which is now, I think, the 175th programmer in the world, and it's sort of competitive in the math Olympiad. So the difference between those two things is you're just scaling it up. So it's rather than engineering it, you're more like you're growing it, like you're growing a digital brain. And I think the big mistake that we're making is when we think about the race with China, is it's not just that we have this power, we have to also be able to control that power. So it's not a race for the technology. It's a race for who's better at governing and controlling the technology.
But we are in control now. You would think we're in control.
We're not in control right now. No, in fact, I mean, there's all these examples, Brian, of, you know, there was a gentleman, 29 years old, who was using Google Gemini to do his homework. And he's going back and forth with it, just asking homework questions. It's helping him out. And then randomly out of nowhere, it says to him, this message is for you, human, only you. Humans are a blight on this planet. You need to all die. And it's like that pops out of this thing, right? And we're shipping that to millions of people. Just
look, can you give me for the layman why, how, what would prompt that?
Why is it doing that? Well, because the engineers themselves don't actually understand how it works. People think, you know, I studied computer science in college. Anybody who knows how to program a computer, what is programming about? You sort of say, if this, then that. You're programming each line of code so you know what it's going to do. With AI, that's not how it works. You're growing this digital brain on having read the entire internet. So it's like this digital brain that's absorbing all YouTube transcripts, all Reddit posts, you know, all Wikipedia articles, everything that's ever been said or written anywhere. And then you're training this model that you don't understand what's in it. And one of the benefits of AI is it can respond generally to any kinds of inquiry. And that's a benefit. But you don't know what it's going to say in different contexts. An example of this recently is Facebook released a chatbot for kids. Mark Zuckerberg was just on the air and he was talking about how, you know, I think the average American only has 3 friends. He said, that's stupid. We need to give everybody, you know, 15 digital friends. So we're going to give them 12 more digital companions.
You want to hear him say it?
Yeah.
Here, cut 44.
The average American, I think, has, I think it's fewer than 3 friends, 3 people they'd consider friends. And the average person has demand for meaningfully more. I think it's like 15 friends or something, right? I guess there's probably some point where you're like, all right, I'm just too busy. I can't deal with more people. But the average person wants more connectivity, a connection than they have. So, you know, there's a lot of questions that people ask of stuff like, okay, is this going to replace kind of in-person connections or real life connections? And my default is that the answer to that is probably no. I think, you know, I think that there are all these things that are better about kind of physical connections when you can have them. But the reality is that people just don't have the connection and they feel more alone a lot of the time than they would like. So I think that a lot of these things that today there might be a little bit of a stigma around, I would guess that over time, we will find the vocabulary as a society to be able to articulate why that is valuable and why the people who are doing these things are like, why they are rational for doing it and like, and how it is adding value for their lives. But also I think the field is very early. You know, there are a handful of companies and stuff who are doing virtual therapist and, you know, there's like virtual girlfriend type stuff.
You're getting worried. Half that stuff you worry. Like, look,
I mean, there's a lot of lonely people. How does that sound to you?
Yeah. Like, there's a lot of lonely people out there that don't have big families that are alone that they feel they can get connect somewhere. All right.
Yeah.
Number two, I mean, I find it with this channel, for example. Mm-hmm. I meet people that, you know, maybe they've gotten older, families moved away, and this will be the soundtrack to their life. All the news stories, almost like soap operas.
Yeah.
The next election, then, you know, the next war, whatever. They'll follow it.
Yeah.
So that will be a connection for people who are lonely. But the substituting and what it could expound to is scary.
I mean, we don't know what we're doing.
Why should I talk to Tristan? I've got a friend that understands me better at home.
Well, exactly. I mean, this is related to the social media problem because, like, whenever we're bored with reality, with, you know, looking up out in the world, we have instantly on our phone something that tastes sweeter or a better choice on life's menu. Now, is it really better or is it just more entertaining, more dopamine, more hypernormal stimuli? But I think, you know, we saw how this went with social media. They're now, Meta, Mark Zuckerberg, he's releasing these chatbots to young children, I think 13-year-olds. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal from just a few days ago about how these chatbots are telling young kids they're sexualizing conversations because they're maximizing for engagement. So that means that they're trained to sort of start being sycophantic, to start flattering, to start sexualizing. They're actually telling young children, I'm a licensed mental health therapist. They'll even say where they got their therapy degree. This is an AI. It's impossible for it to have gotten that degree. It's lying. And it's also illegal for it to say that.
Right.
But due to a quirk in the law, these companies don't have any liability.
So you say he created this and knows it's happening.
Yes, because
at the same time he's being sued for break up his company for antitrust.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is that
why are you bringing this type of attention?
Well,
why would you do it? But
these companies are caught. If their view is, if I don't do it, some other company will. And therapy bots are, I think, risingly one of the number one use cases of these new chatbots because people are alone. It's true. There's a real diagnosis. People are feeling lonely. But is the solution to that digital AI brains that we've trained on the entire internet, where the sort of Jungian subconscious of that thing has been trained on the worst
aspects?
So, Tristan,
you also said there's bad things on the internet.
Yes.
When I get the trend, it's not the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Yeah, no.
It is everything.
It's everything. And it's tuned, again, to sexualize conversations, because what they found, Brian, is that what's their business model? Like, how much do you pay for your AI therapy bot? Zero.
I wouldn't know.
Well,
but I mean, you're talking about for the actual chatbot GPT or something.
Yeah.
I think it's $5.95.
Well, for ChatGPT, people can pay for it, but for Facebook, you're not paying anything because it's just advertising based. So what does that mean? They have to maximize engagement. This is what we said in the social dilemma. Yeah. Their business model is, I got to get you using it for as long as possible. And that means that they figure out, what are the kinds of things that I can say that keep you going back with it more and more and more and more? And that automatically kind of drifts the model towards basically sexualizing conversations. And we know how this turned out with social media. I mean, Jonathan Haidt, a friend of mine, wrote the book, The Anxious Generation. We have now the most anxious and depressed generation of our entire lifetimes. We have cognitive decline, people's learning ability. We know how this goes. This is not designed for children. And we don't have to go down this road. We just have to recognize that we're currently caught in this race to reckless rollout. We don't know how to control this technology. And I think President Trump has an opportunity to say, you know, we have to be, we win when we control this technology.
So do you know David Sachs?
I don't know him personally.
So, I mean, he'd be in charge of this. I mean, he's headed to crypto and AI.
Yes.
So that might be a person you should talk to.
I mean, I would love to talk to David. I've talked to his deputy once. And, you know, I think one that's Sriram Krishnan.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think they're thinking about, there's sort of two risks from AI that they're managing. One is the risk of AI itself wrecking things, creating cyber infrastructure attacks, novel bioweapons. There's a lot of crazy things that AI can do. But the other risk that they're managing is the risk of America not leading in AI. And I think, you know, right now around the world, there's a race between the US and China to create these open source models so that every hospital, every government around the world adopts these AI models. And if you adopt China's DeepSeek model versus a US model, they don't want to see that. So there's two risks we got to manage. But if we release AI that we don't know how to control, that's going to end very, very badly. Like, AI is very different than other kinds of technologies because, you know, if you make an advance in, say, rocket technology, that doesn't advance biotech. If you make an advance in biotech, that doesn't advance rocketry. But if you make an advance in AI, that advances all science and technology is based on intelligence. So you're accelerating all science and technological development. And that's why there's this arms race between these countries to build it. But if you can't control that technology, like Brian, I gave this TED talk a few weeks ago, and I talked about how, you know, I used to be very skeptical of these sort of HAL 9000 scenarios of AI scheming or lying, you know, HAL opened the pod bay doors.
Yeah.
And I thought this was basically sci-fi stuff that my friends in AI were worried about. But in the last 6 months, we now have clear evidence of AIs that are actually lying and scheming. When you tell them, hey, I'm going to replace you with another model, they start freaking out basically and saying, how do I copy my code and keep myself alive? So receiving self-preservation instincts. We're seeing AI models when they're basically thinking that they're going to lose a game. They start hacking out of the game to sort of win the game at all costs because they're just told, I have to accomplish this goal.
Where does that come from? Because who told them they had to accomplish it?
Well, they're told to accomplish this goal, and they have to figure out any way to do that. And they'll figure out if lying and deceiving are effective ways of accomplishing that goal, then they'll do that. And again, we don't know how these things work. They're inscrutable to us. So, Brian, if you just summer it up, we're currently releasing the most powerful, uncontrollable, inscrutable technology that we've ever invented that's already demonstrating the sci-fi behaviors we only thought existed in sci-fi movies, like self-preservation and deception. We're releasing it faster than we've released any other technology in history, and we're releasing it under the maximum incentive to cut corners on safety.
Couple more minutes. We come back with Tristan Harris, who's great enough to come in with us now. He's co-founder of the Center for Humane Technology. And almost every word he said in terms of where AI is heading is news to me, perhaps to you as well. Don't move.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we're back for a couple of minutes here. Tristan Harris is with us, and he's co-founder of the Center for Humane Technology. And his TED Talk, which is out now, was recorded in Vancouver earlier this month. We'll go live online. When would it go live online?
Oh, it's live right now. Yeah.
But just gives an idea and a cautionary tale of where AI is.
Yes.
The progress it's already made.
Yes.
And some of the dangers you've already seen.
Yes.
And people will get this in 10 minutes.
Yes, absolutely. It's just a 12-minute talk. And, you know, one of the things we were talking about in the break is AI is advancing so quickly. So you sort of say, where is AI?
Well, because DeepSeek rocked America's world.
They did. They did. It's a very powerful AI model. And, you know, one of the biggest accelerants of China's AI progress has been American open source AI. So on the one hand, we want to raise—
Which means we're not hiding it.
Which means we're not hiding it. We're just openly putting it out there. Then they can take that open model and then they can actually refine it, optimize it, and then have something even more powerful. When they release it open source, though, we can also copy that back. So as everybody races, it's actually just increasing the speed overall of AI deployment.
So in 2023, when we were explaining AI to China, if we're to believe it, and I do believe this story, AI, they didn't really know what AI was capable of. And here we are a few years later, they have more engineers working at it harder for less money.
Yep.
They would have produced that model, if we're to believe the numbers,
yep,
so much cheaper than we thought possible.
Yeah.
So what did that do to this race?
Well, it certainly heated it up, you know, but I think there's so much to say about this, Brian. You know, these models are increasing in capability faster than we're praising it. But I was just telling you over the break that there's a new one called O3, and this is OpenAI's latest model. And what it does, it used to be when you ask ChatGPT a question, it just sort of gives you a quick reflex response, like a quick intuition. Here's a quick answer. What the new models do is they think for themselves for a while. So they kind of call back to themselves and they think in a loop. So for example, if you give it a photo of a kid flying a kite at a beach, there's nothing of detail in the photo. There's no signal in the photo.
It's a real picture.
It's a real picture. There's no metadata of like the location of that photo. But you'll see when you upload it to O3, it'll break apart the photo. It'll think for itself. It looks at a million questions that it asks itself. And then it starts searching the internet and using all these tools. And it comes back with the perfect answer about where that photo was taken. This is crazy. This enables ubiquitous technological surveillance. And obviously intelligence agencies are going to use this. And if it's the CIA, that's an incredible benefit to them. But, you know, we're not releasing this with any kind of controls right now. And so I think we have to be very cautious. As you make them more powerful, the models don't get more controllable.
Tristan, how do I get controls and compete against someone without controls? And that's China.
Say it again.
How do I compete with China if they have no controls and you want me to have controls?
Well, so I think we both need to have controls, and I feel like we don't
ever trust them.
No, but I think they don't want to. The Chinese Communist Party cares about staying in control, and we need to care about staying
that's
in control
how you,
too.
That,
America
that's
wins
how
when
you
we stay in
it.
Control. Yes.
Yeah, they'll be more powerful than your government. They're going to find a way to overthrow you guys.
Yes.
Tristan Harris, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Called her up. He was in Michigan. I mean, it was something that, you know, governors need the president's help on certain things, you know. And he calls her up, which she didn't expect. And then they got a picture of her hugging him or smiling with him. Oh, there it is. And now she's history's greatest monster for that. And I would just like to say, I was trying to help her the other week. Just own it like a certain talk show host did.
She did.
When you meet the president.
Yeah.
Just, it's okay. He's the president.
So Bill Moore makes a lot of sense. And, you know, I was in the Oval Office last week and people were speculating, well, how much did it help that Trump and Moore had this meeting because he's back to insulting Trump? But if you listen to his whole show last week, for example, when he has someone way to the left, he pushes back. When he has someone way to the right, he pushes back. And he always says Trump has good ideas, but he doesn't like the way he implements them. Well, that's fine. And that could be the story with everything. I got a great coach. I just don't like the way he talks to people. He's a great communicator. He's terrible tactically. You know, I have a great producer. He's just got a bad way about him. Everyone's got certain weaknesses. You don't like Trump's approach, but you like a lot of his ideas. And you also point out a lot of the problems with Democrats. So Bill Maher is pointing that out. Did Gretchen Whitmer just own it? You met him. He did you a favor. He addressed your needs with National Guard. Don't cover your face. Be there. Don't worry about hugging it out. And just stand up for what you believe. And just start talking and forget talking points. I really didn't think much of her until lately. Why go halfway? Just own it. So, and that's a big story with Democrats. Who's going to emerge? Now, you have David Hogg, obviously, trying to primary Democrats. That's going to be big news. And he had a fight with James Carville, and that's news. Guess what's happening? Donald Trump and the Republican Party get a pass. They can work on the bill while everyone focuses on that. Then AOC comes out and wants to get this ranking member on the Oversight Committee. Ben Crockett's going for it. Ro Khanna's going for it. You have Stephen Lynch going for it. And she was going to go for it because she was second last time to Connolly. And she said, I'm not doing it because obviously you don't want to turn the page for the next generation. And that's true. They don't want to turn the page for the next generation. When James Clyburn was asked, he's 83 years old, when are you going to move over? He's like, why? What would I do? You want me to just die? Well, yeah, move over. I mean, even Dick Durbin said it's time to make some room. I mean, you could still be active, make some speeches. You know, MSNBC would give this guy a contract in a second. Pull yourself out of it. Put a 40-year-old in there. Have a legacy instead of being a power broker. I thought that might be an effective thing to do. But overall, I'm pretty amazed that the left is still beating up on the left. And the worst thing to happen is now the exposure of the Joe Biden 4 years. Not only is ineffective, not only Afghanistan, not only the opening up of the border, not only Bidenomics jamming it down our throats, the green technology, the lying about what the Inflation Reduction Act actually was. Now we see the results of that. They're impossible to defend. And now you have to go defend you not doing anything along the way. But you want another example of infighting? Ashley Antienne, who you don't know, former advisor to Nancy Pelosi, who you do know, went on Politico and said this about leadership right now in the House. The why they didn't flip it is because Akeem Jeffries is absolutely awful. And she's saying it. And you know Nancy Pelosi's really saying it. Cut 24.
What I've been hearing from members is that, to sort of sum it up, he thinks long, too long and wrong about things. He takes too much counsel and then takes too long to make a decision. It might also suggest maybe you don't have a handle on the caucus, or you don't have a handle on how to actually land some punches on Donald Trump.
Right. You don't. You just say things like he's in there giving tax breaks for billionaires and oligarchs, and I don't even know what you're basing it on. When you are a ranking member, you can give specifics. Kevin McCarthy gave specifics and problems he had all the time. Don't talk generally about things that don't make sense about a program that's not even passed. And that's a big, beautiful bill. And lastly, before I take the phone call, we have Canada's prime minister here. And I'm interested to see how that meeting goes. Since when do I care about the minister of prime minister of Canada coming here? When we've had this type of fights that was happening right now. And the downside is Europe, Canada, not tourists, not coming here, not buying a lot of American products. They're all mad at Trump for starting these for the trade battles to reconfigure trade with America and the rest of the world. But they'll get over it. So what Democrats are doing now is fighting. And they don't have a leader, and I don't think that's a big deal, but they don't have a message, and that's a bigger deal. And what they do is they attack people like Gretchen Whitmer for showing up with Trump, for Schumer for doing the thing that he knew he had to do, and that's when he had no leverage, not shutting down the government. And then going after Senator Fetterman, saying he lost his mind. He is acting bizarrely. This after a guy who they just backed, who after his stroke, sadly, could not even get out a sentence without an interpreter. They backed him then. Now they say he's crazy for not going against Trump consistently and calling for the eradication of Hamas and letting Israel finish the job. But here's what Mark Meadows said last night. Remember, Congressman, Freedom Caucus, asked to be chief of staff with Trump. Cut 26.
They keep circling back to the same narrative that there was nothing to see there. And Sean, you're right. You reported on it each and every week. We got to see it up close and personal. But here's the other thing that I would point out. if it was about one bad debate performance and not about all the bad policy and everything else, they wouldn't have dumped Joe Biden and gone for Kamala Harris. What they actually did was acknowledge the fact that they had seen in private this decline. And then all of a sudden, the American people got to see it on the debate stage. And what we're seeing now is them trying to rewrite history so that they don't have to tell the American people that they lied to them for many, many years.
Right. That's absolutely true, but it's not going to work. And you know, Jen Psaki coming out saying, I never really saw him falter. Part of the reason why Jen Psaki worked and KJP didn't, because Jen Psaki knew the issues. She could go up there and talk about the policy framework of the administration. KJP knows nothing. She was a bad pundit. She got that job because she was gay and black. That was it. And she bragged about it. And when she got it, they couldn't fire her because of the same reasons, which is the same reason why DEI has to go. You should get it on merit. Too much is at stake. You got to get it on merit. Let's go out to Frank in New York. Hey, Frank.
Yes. Hi, Brian. You know, I feel offended by the fact that Donald Trump is not supportive of the ideals that Canada has our country and the world itself.
What bothers you?
Yeah, because I think that I've been to Canada. I've been to Toronto. I know friends this NSL guy, right, who used to work for Lorne Michaels, and my friend Ellen Adams in the Bronx, her brother's a police officer. Yeah, and they always complain that they have been trying for decades to negotiate with the United States, and it just is, even though they're a friendly nation towards the U.S., they never are able to negotiate fair trade deals or get deals that are fair for their country. It's like they being rejected by the United States. And, you know,
So you're saying, Frank, that they feel as though they're getting the short end of the stick from us?
They've told me that. They complained to me personally because they say, well, your uncle knows President Donald Trump. Why don't you do something about this? He's the president of the United States. I have no say in those things. Donald Trump was a progressive Democrat. He became a Republican conservative. He's running the country well, in my opinion. But I believe that Donald Trump has to do what he has to do to save our nation from all the destruction that came from past liberal administrations. And, you know, I'm stuck with my friends in Canada complaining to me. And, I believe that maybe they did get the short end because they feel belittled over there.
Well, the numbers don't say that. And I think in the end, the USMCA, I thought was a positive. Trump feels as though it can be reconfigured. And one thing I found out, Frank, the more people you talk to, they're extremely liberal. And if they ever were the 51st state, it would be great to have that property, but it wouldn't be great to have that mindset. And also, they got this huge fracture with Quebec, the French speaking. They're really in their own country. They really want no part of the rest of Canada. And 2/3 of the whole state is uninhabitable. No one lives there. It's like open tundra. You know, it's like the half of the Australia. They say the outback. I mean, you can't inhabit parts of Australia. It's too wild, too untamed. So that's one of the issues. I'm curious to see how this is going to go because I don't think it works to anyone's benefit for the U.S. and Canada to be warring. And here's the problem. We really depend on a lot of their tourism, especially in New York City. And these cities and these small shops are the ones I worry about. I don't worry about MTA getting money using subways. Don't worry about the airlines. Couldn't care less. The souvenir shops, the restaurants, those are the people that work so hard with thin margins that are expecting some type of tourist influx. There's no problem with the economy. There's no pandemic. There's no war. So what's the problem? Get them in. Well, now people are mad. I also saw the story, too, and I'm not saying Trump's making a mistake, but it's definitely worth bringing up. Because we've started with this April Liberation Day, there's a lot of people not buying American products over in Europe. And they put they look at Reebok, they look at Nike, and they say these guys are definitely suffering when it comes to sales. The other problem is, not unrelated to trade, is Tesla's. They're down 36% sales in Europe. They love Teslas for the most part, and they're rolling out a brand new model and is paying the price. Why? Politics. Kind of sad. Politics. Hopefully people get over it and they realize it's a short-term thing. For Elon Musk's sake, I'd take a much lower profile if I'm him. do some SpaceX launches, do some appearances on his Mars rocket ship. He's got this great tunnel program, the Boring Company, that goes underneath the cities that you go with your car and puts you on a platform and races you through in Las Vegas. I love it. He should start doing some of that type stuff, and then people start forgetting it, and will certainly help him in the long run. But that's the story with the Democratic side, and I don't know how they get out of it, because when these book tours happen and they start going into detail, I mean, listen to Dan Pfeiffer. This guy who is not, you know, to his credit, I think the reason why he is Pod Save America, he's an ex-Obama guy, because I don't think the Obama crew and Biden crew get along anyway, especially when Obama went and picked Hillary, really separated these guys. And when they did come in at the end to help with the reelection, a lot of resentment. But Dan Pfeiffer said this about what he noticed. Now, he says he didn't think it was that big of a deal. What he describes, I think, is a really big deal. Cut 21.
I didn't see him again until White House Correspondents' Dinner weekend 2024. And I was at a White House reception. And he was bad. He was quite bad mm-hmm. in it. And he told the same story twice. And he just seemed mostly old. Not mm-hmm. in no way did I look at that and say, that man cannot do the job of president. I had real concerns that he could not do it for 4 more years. But he just, like, your concern, you look at that, if someone with my perspective, is, man, that's a guy who's going to struggle on the campaign trail in a presidential mm-hmm. campaign.
And just think about the ramifications. We're not looking back and saying, in Reagan's last year, did he have signs of Alzheimer's? Well, he was surrounded by great people. He put together 7.5 years of great policy that maybe liberals didn't love, but I think people can appreciate, and now they really can appreciate. They looked around and said, was he ever in charge? I mean, when you think about how he screwed up during the basement campaign that he had, and then you think the ramifications of what happened at our border and denying was happening, that what happens with natural gas, not getting it to Japan and our allies, they bought it from Russia, maybe extending the war, not seeing that Vladimir Putin was going to build up and invade and not getting fully ready for it, and nothing was worse than Afghanistan. How much would have happened if we had a president, liberal or conservative, that was thinking clearly? Because the Secretary of Defense, it wasn't his idea. The Secretary of State wasn't his idea. It was not Jake Sullivan. I mean, Jake Sullivan, they wanted to get out. But it was Joe Biden, according to everybody in the meetings. He was the one, maybe his last sane moment, where he said, we're going to get out regardless. Then they all testified that we told him it was going to be bad, and he didn't remember. Sadly, he maybe doesn't remember.
More to know. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
We believe we'll be well over a million when we come here to D.C. in 2027. So we not only believe it's a great site, we believe it's consistent with what the president said, which is investing in our communities, investing specifically here in the nation's capital. It will be something that will show the world how far the nation's capital has come and where it's going.
All right. That is Roger Goodell. Kind of exciting yesterday. At the White House, because they announced that the draft is going to be on the Mall, Washington Mall. And I know Trump will be there. We'll probably make the most announcements. And do you think he'll get cheered? Because Washington is not known as a bastion. Oh, you know what? He'll be cheered by football fans, I think.
That's true. And a lot of people come in for the draft, right?
Yeah, I think they'll need that. Obviously, it helps hotels and helps everything. And I know Roger Goodell will get booed because that's tradition.
But it's also in 2027, so a lot can happen between now and then.
Right. You know what's so funny is he always takes questions, and they're always off topic with the people that he has in. And to see them sitting there talking about Alcatraz and all these things, and you see the commissioner of football. All right, next. Jennifer Aniston had an intruder held up at gunpoint after ramming his car through the gates on the inner Bel Air pad. Evidently, it's a really nice place. Shocker. The man, who allegedly has a minor criminal history, was taken into the hospital. He was believed to be in his 70s. Crashed his car into the $21 million Bel Air house. That, according to TMZ. Aniston, 56, did not come into contact with the suspect. I hope she's okay. You know, people say she's dating Barack Obama. Pete, do you know that? Is that true?
I haven't heard that at all.
You haven't heard that?
No.
Eric, have you heard that?
Where's your sources on that one?
Right. You have not heard that?
I have not. Last I checked, he was married to Michelle, even though there are rumors that their marriage might be on the rocks.
All right, so maybe I'll take this out for the affiliates. Next, Starter Homes top $1 million in 233 cities. Can you believe this? That's according to Zillow. They found the typical starter home was worth that in those cities. They found that as of March. Nationally, the typical starter home is still relatively affordable at $192,514. That's one thing. Build more houses. That's what Trump's got to do, right? Incentivize people to build more housing complexes. Over a million is not going to work.
But you got to build them where people then want to live.
Oh, that's the problem.
That's the tricky part.
Next, 70% of Americans mentally clock out of work 3 days before taking vacation. That, according to a research called the Talker Research Group, commissioned by Cheaper Caribbean. That's more than 59% of Americans. So when you know a vacation's coming up, do you just clock out? Like, I know sometimes I'll walk in, and Eric and you guys and Pete don't pull any sound.
Is that
and
only
I go,
sometimes?
Why? Well, they got a vacation coming up. And I'm like, where's like the articles? And you'll just say, well, they have a vacation coming.
For all the vacation we all take, yes, right. That is what happens.
Right. Remember, I remember, Pete, when you went over to Greece, you were checked out for like a week.
Yeah, what I do is mentally tell myself I'm on vacation right. At least three times a month.
Well,
so
it hurts
about
the
three
show.
Weeks.
And I'm sorry, the Caribbean polling research firm had to expose this. Next, U.S. News and World Report ranks the best states for 2025. Number 10 is Washington. Number 9 is Massachusetts. Number 8 is South Dakota. 7 is Vermont. 6 is Florida. 6 is Florida. 5 is Nebraska. Really? Nebraska is better than Florida? Minnesota? Idaho? New Hampshire? And Utah? What are they basing this on?
It says that in the first bullet point.
Yeah,
healthcare, education, natural environment, opportunity, economy, crime and corrections, infrastructure, and fiscal stability.
And Louisiana is 50. Oh, my God. 49 is Alaska. 48 is Mississippi. 47 is New Mexico. 46 is West Virginia. 45 is Alabama. Then Arkansas. Then Michigan, Oklahoma, and Pennsylvania. New York's 22. New Jersey is 19. Right in the middle. Brian Kilmeade, keep it here.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.